95% of ministry is joy. There is another 5%. I experienced that this week. We had a strange letter come to our church addressed to Pastor so-and-so. I'm not sure that doesn't mean he doesn't know my name. I think that means what you think it means. I had the misfortune to see your huge edifice of falsehood and was extremely sickened by it. Here's a quarter. It was taped on the sheet, but I've put it in the piggy bank. Call someone who cares. Disrespectfully yours, Mr. Nobody. P.S. In your address, which is 9209 East 29th, there is 3 upside-down sixes. You know what that means, of course. 666 in Revelation is the mark of the Antichrist, so either somebody is playing games or at least one person in the whole wide world doesn't like us. But I'm going to be talking this morning about what you do about that, so please listen. A certain fifth grade teacher every year has a contest in which the students pick one sentence, name the author, and the source where the sentence appears, and then explain why this is their pick for the greatest sentence ever written. Now you can guess what some of them would be. 47 years ago. Or, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Or, to be or not to be. Or that famous beginning of a Dickens novel, it was the worst of times, it was the best of times. And in a blatant case of apple polishing, since the teacher announced this sentence as her choice when she gave the assignment, something, Jan, every teacher should know better than to do, 14 entries for the same biblical verse. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But the sentence that won this year was not written by a famous author at all. In fact, it was written by an 11-year-old girl's new stepfather. It appeared in no published document. It was pinned on a postcard sent to this girl named Charlotte from Hawaii, where her new stepdad and her mother were on their honeymoon. The teacher was a little uneasy at first about Charlotte's unusual nomination, but when the little girl told why the sentence on the card was her pick, the teacher's worries disappeared. Charlotte explained that until she received that postcard, she had been frightened about her new life with no idea how her new stepfather felt about her. Here is Charlotte's winning entry, squeezed into a cramped space on the back of a picture postcard from Waikiki Beach. 4 words, Charlotte, I love you. That's as much as I know about that true story, so I have no idea whether the stepdad meant it seriously enough to prove it to Charlotte over and over when he came back home with her mother. But give him at least an opening credit. He took the time to write. And for Charlotte, that simple little act changed the climate. Love in action. The title I gave this morning's sermon gives the whole thing away. And those of you who survived last year's 24 sermon series on love, know already that the kind I will be talking about is agape love, from the word used in the New Testament to describe a commitment to treating people right, no matter how we feel about them. Liking someone is an emotional response. Loving someone in the Christian sense is an act of will. It is actually possible to say, I can't stand the guy, and still fulfill the command of Christ to love the unpleasant so-and-so. That is, to treat him fairly and kindly. It's an easy matter to love someone whom we like, someone who provokes a warm emotional response. You've all said it more than once, gosh, I liked her from the minute she walked into the room. If something bad happens to a person we like, it's easy to respond with sympathy. But what do we do if the disaster happens to a neighbor or classmate or fellow church member who is so arrogant and mean-spirited that we duck into doorways to avoid bumping into him? Can we make ourselves be patient or repay the annoying egotism and bluster with quiet goodwill, hoping, holding on to hope that his affliction will pass one of these days and he will be well? Probably not. Because this requires the persistence of agape love, that new thing in the Apostle Paul's religion, which is neither romantic yearning, nor infatuation, nor the chemistry of kindred spirits, but a determination to do the decent and kindly thing, whether we like somebody or not. Sometimes, when we persist in goodwill, the disagreeable person responds, and friendship is possible, but not always. And the reward of friendship is not the reason for agape love. According to sacred scripture, if we love like that, we know something important about the nature of God. So how can anything have more urgency than to know exactly what agape love means in the sentence, you are to love your neighbor as you love yourself? If it helps to understand what that means, try remembering this, that on some days you like yourself. On some days, you don't like yourself, but on all the days, what you really want for yourself is the best you can have, which means you love yourself. Once we understand that Christian love is not governed by emotion, but by will, we begin to understand certain things said by Christ that otherwise make no sense. If a man in authority, he said to people one day, if a man in authority makes you go 1 mile, go with him 2. I'd like to have seen the look on the faces in his audience at the end of that sentence. The Roman army was occupying Palestine just then. And soldiers at times forced Jewish people into compulsory service. You can imagine how much a Jew, compelled to carry some load alongside a Roman, would wish he could stick a knife in the soldier's back, and how well the soldier would know it, and how at the end they would both hate each other forever. more than ever. It was a hopeless job just then to resist Rome. So Jesus says, take it with good grace. The next time a Roman forces you to be his guide or pack horse, when you finish the mile, instead of a hateful look, ask pleasantly if you can be of any further service. I have good friends who wouldn't mince words about that advice for one second. Silliest damn nonsense I ever heard in my life. No wonder people pay so little attention to preachers. The wisdom of Jesus is fine for church, forgotten on the street. Partly because we get it distorted by trying to read the Bible as if it were written last week in Tulsa instead of 2,000 years ago in a little country squirming under Roman military occupation. It isn't enough to translate New Testament Greek into English. We have to translate first century social and economic contexts into 20th century contexts, or we interpret grotesquely some of the things Jesus said. Things like, give to everyone who begs from you. Don't refuse anyone who wants to borrow. And if a guy takes your coat, offer your vest. And if somebody pops you on one cheek, turn the other. These are not laws for the unimaginative. These are vivid, startling, half-humorous flashes of poetry to illuminate the response of agape love in any situation where it has the slightest chance to work. Maybe the most helpful thing I can say is, if you thought of wanting the best, if the thought of wanting the very best for some belligerent enemy makes you want to throw up, if it goes painfully against the grain to treat someone well, what you are being called upon to express is that unnatural love called agape, the sublime foolishness that confounds the wisdom of the world. You remember the quote from Mother Teresa a couple of Sundays back, I do what I can where I am with what I have. I say it again from this pulpit because it suggests that for most of us, agape love will be shown to others in a lot of small and very ordinary ways. Some of them occasionally rather strange. Those of you who are married and have been married a long time know this, and you can relate to the older couple I noticed years ago during church services who still seemed quite enamored of each other. They held hands all during the service, and so I finally mentioned it to them one day, something about what an inspiration they were, acting like teenagers in love, even holding hands all the time. The wife, with a slightly exasperated look, said, well, it's not romance exactly. It's the only way I can keep him from cracking his knuckles in church. I mean, for those you love, you do what you can. And sometimes what you do is as truly heroic as anything human beings are capable of. I read a letter the other day that was written almost 50 years ago. And it struck me as an illustration of the love in action this sermon is about. A sailor named Kim, Malte Brune or something, a German or Scandinavian, I'm not sure, was executed for resisting the Nazis. He wrote this extraordinary letter back home to his mother. And it was thrilling to me to read it and know that human beings are capable of writing such letters. Dear Mother, today, together with Jorgen, Niels, and Ludwig, I was arraigned before a military tribunal. We were condemned to death. I know that you will bear this, but hear me, it is not enough to bear it. You must also understand it. I am an insignificant thing, and my person will soon be forgotten. But the thought, the life, the inspiration that filled me will live on. You will meet them everywhere, in the trees, at springtime, in people who cross your path, in a loving little smile. You will encounter that something which perhaps had value in me. You will cherish it, and you will not forget me. And so I shall have a chance to grow, to become large and mature. I shall be living with all of you whose hearts I once filled. Finally, there is a girl I had hoped to marry. Make her realize that the stars still shine and that I have been only a milestone on her road. Help her on. She can still become very happy. In haste, your eldest child and only son, Kim. Those are the words of a young man who had gotten rid of the last vestige of self-love and had reached something better. I had this sermon on my mind last week when I drove down to Oklahoma City for an overnight to help a young minister build a new room for an unexpected child. At some point in our work, this man turned to his wife and said, "Sean, guess who I saw yesterday? I don't think he saw me, but I saw Fletcher. Remember? Fletcher Baldridge. Big, tall kid now with long hair and a ponytail." I heard them talk, but my mind was turning back to a sermon I shared with you 7 years ago. I had used a story in it to show how much we need to be loved and how in that odd way of things, sermons and life bump into each other. Just when I was thinking about love in action, standing here today, this kid's name came up. For the first time since 1986. I don't like to repeat something from 7 years ago, but this works. I have to do it. I'd been down in Oklahoma City then too, for the same reason, to help my son do some work. All fathers will understand. And I met a little boy named Fletcher Baldridge, favorite playmate of my grandson, Blue. I thought he had some strikes against him already, just to be named Fletcher in Oklahoma. I mean, Joe Bob or Jimmy Jack or even Rising Red Feather, but not Fletcher Baldridge with its exotic sound of English aristocracy. But that burden was nothing compared to Fletcher's physical problem. He'd been thrown through a windshield a couple of years before in a terrible car wreck. He has an enormous ridge of scar tissue down the middle of his chest and stomach, and on one side of his throat, a plastic tube where the carotid artery used to be. Somehow, although I don't understand this, he had been changed in that trauma from being left-handed to being right-handed, and he wasn't well coordinated anymore at all. He couldn't run well at school, so the kids laughed at him when he came in about 50 feet behind everybody else. They called him a freak and an oddball. And I wondered how this 8 or 9 year old would turn out. And one day back then, when my son Robin came home from work, he jumped out of his car and yelled for his son Blue to come give him a welcome. Robin lives in a cul-de-sac and has no awareness that there are other neighbors close. He shouts, "I want a hug." Well, Blue, who gets all the hugs he needs, was in no hurry. He had something else on his mind, and he paid no attention, at least for the moment, probably embarrassed. Fletcher, this odd child, saw this happen. I don't know what was in his head, whether he felt sorry for Robin and wanted to substitute for Blue, or whether he forgot everything but the huge hunger in his own heart. What I know is that he walked over to Robin and looked up and said, "I sure would like a hug, Mr. Myers. I don't have a daddy." I only saw Fletcher once or twice 7 years ago, and I didn't see him last week when he apparently came back to Oklahoma City from wherever he is living now at 16 or 17 with God knows what other scars that may have been inflicted on him by this time. But I hope he met a few friends and strangers along the way who knew enough about agape love to give him a hug or two. It's been a day of stories, so one more to show you that even the most manly of great athletes, without any awkward talk or sentimental syrup, can show quietly what it means to love someone in the strong way of agape love. Longtime baseball fans will remember Joe Gordon, who in 1947 was in his prime as a great second baseman with the Cleveland Indians. It was in that same year that Larry Doby came to play for Cleveland. Somebody shake a head. Yes, I remember these people. Thank you, sir. I was beginning to feel terribly alone. Larry Doby came to play for Cleveland as the first black rookie to join an American League team. Well, Doby was understandably tense and nervous when he stepped up for his first time at bat. He swung at 3 pitches, and like some good friends of ours yesterday, missed every one of them by what seemed to be a foot. He walked back to the dugout with his head down, walked past every other player on the bench, and slouched in the corner alone with his head in his hands. Joe Gordon, a power hitter, was the next man up. And the opposing pitcher that day was one Joe Gordon usually blasted out of the park. But this time, he went up to the plate and missed 3 pitches in a row, each of them by what seemed at least a foot. He returned to the dugout, walked past every other player on the bench, sat down in the corner next to Larry Doby, and put his head in his hands. No one ever asked Joe Gordon if he struck out deliberately. But ever after that, as long as they played together, every time Larry Doby went out on the field, he first picked up Joe Gordon's glove and tossed it to him. And Larry Doby went on to become one of the great hitters in Major League history. Maybe he would have done it anyway, without that moment of special thoughtfulness, but who knows? I like to think that this is part of what the Apostle Paul had in mind when he said that agape love is forever looking for a chance to build up another person. You'll have the chance this week if you have eyes to see.